You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Time to talk about the Clean. The Clean, you probably know this, but I'll just give you a little introduction to them in case you don't, in case you're new to them. Unlikely, but they're the band that, along with Chris Knox's The Enemy, put Dunedin music on the map. They formed in 1978. There were three of them. The Kilgour brothers, Hamish Kilgour and his younger brother David, who were joined by bass player Peter Gutteridge. And a couple of years later, after Peter Gutteridge left the band, they found a permanent bass player in Robert Scott, who went on to play in the Bats, still does. And the Clean were signed to the fledgling record label as they were then. They weren't even a record label, out of Christchurch, Flying Nun. And in fact, Roger Shepherd was determined to make a record with this band, and the single that they recorded, Tally Ho and Platypus, Tally Ho, made it to the top 20, which was actually a massive breakthrough at the time, as radio in New Zealand was determined not to play New Zealand music, certainly nothing that was deemed independent. So now author Richard Langston has written a biography of the Clean. It's called In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul, and I'm very much hoping he's with us now on Zoom. Morena, Richard.
Morena, Karen. And you're dead right about Tally Ho, that, conventional radio programmers sort of presented with this small piece of deviant plastic vinyl, more or less cast it in the rubbish bin and said, we don't play music like that. In fact, we don't even recognise that as music. That doesn't sound like Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, that's so right. And they use the excuse, it's not very well produced.
Yes, all the time, you could have said the same thing about the first Rolling Stones singles. They were recorded pretty much in the manner that the Clean were recording in Dunedin in 1980, and in 81 they made Tally Ho, more or less in a Christchurch sort of studio lounge. Very fundamental recording, but so were those early Stones recordings. They were made on two-track as well, and the Clean were really attracted to that sound. So the irony is the Clean always cared a great deal about their sound. Just the sound they like wasn't necessarily the sound that radio recognised as a broadcastable.
Yeah, that's right. I love the way that you put this book together, Richard. It's deceptively casual, I think that's the right word. The interviews and the diary entries and the letters home, they reveal so much about the band dynamic, but both musically and also personally. And I found the story to be captivating from start to finish and really wonderfully understated in its execution, which is pretty much like the Clean themselves.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm pleased you picked up on that because, the approach of particularly David Kilgour and Hamish and Robert, they're laconic characters. They are not boosters. They're not they would never attempt to be influencers in the modern sense because they're very sort of modest. They just go about doing, they're creative artists of the highest caliber. You would never hear them say that. They're very understated people. So the book had to be in the spirit of the Clean. And the fact that you found it captivating from the start is simply the fact that their story was so interesting. Everybody thought they, including myself, I thought I knew this, because I've been a Clean freak for 40 years, I thought I knew their story. It wasn't until I started interviewing them that I really found out the details of their story. And the details of their story are magic. It's such a great story of people coming off farms, coming from small rural towns, who are absolute culture and music freaks, and finding their feet in the city and just having a just creating, finding their voice and doing what they want to do. It wasn't easy. In fact, it was really difficult for them, and they had many failures. And they're very open and funny about their failures, including their first trip to Auckland in 1979, when they actually failed to get there and had a sort of existential meltdown in Christchurch and went home to Dunedin. David is 17, Hamish is 21. They're just children, trying to go to the big smoke without their bass player Peter Gutteridge, who they've just sacked. So
right, and Auckland was very hardcore at that time. It really was. It was post-punk boot boy territory. Yeah. It was kind of dangerous on the streets.
Yeah, well, they spell that out, that a brick was hurled through their window. One of their mates got beaten up in a Central City flat, and I think just off Ponsonby Road somewhere. And so it was a very violent time. There was a lot of gang confrontation. The police were violent and openly so. I think there's an incident in the book where David Kilgour basically tells Paul Keane from Toy Love to pull his head in, or he's going to get beaten up by the police. The team policing at that time was really aggressive. They used to come into pubs, I remember it distinctly.
Same. Yep. Yes, they
Yeah,
did.
so hopefully we've come a long way since then, because it wasn't pleasant at all. It was kind of frightening,
Yeah, and the paradox is that I was really surprised to find out musically that Split Enz had been a big influence on the Clean, especially Hamish. Also, a huge love of the Doors and the Velvet Underground. And Hamish said at the time, or in the book, I don't know when he actually said this, that they deliberately created pop music, quote, because it makes us happy and we tried to make people happy.
The Split Enz thing was interesting. Martin Phillips was also a big Split Enz person, so the Dunedin people were inspired by Split Enz. Even though at that time, when punk came along, Split Enz kind of, I think, felt themselves slightly out of the picture in that they weren't a punk or new wave band. And they got some, I remember John Lydon was quite rude about Split Enz. And Hamish took umbrage at that because he had been inspired by Split Enz. He'd seen them walking in the street in Dunedin in 1977, as he describes it in the book, and they were dressed radically. I mean, I think that was the time maybe of dysrhythmia, or maybe that came later. Maybe it was, anyway, it was mid-70s, and they had a look, crazy haircuts. And Hamish was inspired by this, that you could be yourself. And that's really important in terms of being a creative artist, because here we're New Zealanders, Split Enz, leading the way and looking like yourself and doing what you want to do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It really sums it up because, especially with Hamish's personality, and I'm speaking about Hamish here, and David was a different character altogether, musically and personally. But I first met Hamish Richard in 1980. I was working at Radio Hauraki. I'd been on air, but up until that point, I'd been a copywriter. And I was seconded with a couple of other people to go from Radio Hauraki to go to Dunedin to 4XO. And I was given the title of copy consultant, which was
Copy
a
consultant.
copy consultant, yeah. Tasked with teaching their copywriters how to write, one of whom was Hamish Kilgour. So we had a great laugh about that. I think we just smoked a whole lot of dope and spent some time mucking
Yeah,
about.
well, good. Well, you would have been a fellow traveller with Hamish, because that 1980 is a really interesting year. So, he had come back to Dunedin from Auckland, where he had spent, most of that year, and he'd come back at a bit of a loose end. But he'd come back for a good reason, because David had discovered Robert Scott. David had gone to visit his girlfriend Genevieve in a high street flat in Dunedin, and here's Bob. I think David had seen him at art school. Anyway, they must have got talking, because Bob ended up playing the bass in the bedroom, and David played him the guitar line from At the Bottom, which became a fundamental Clean song. This is their first meeting. They jammed At the Bottom. That is the start of the second coming of the Clean, and I just love that story. So that's what prompted, and Hamish heard this, or David rang him in Auckland and said, "Come back, I found the guy crazy enough to play with us." And so he did come back, and that's when you would have met. And he writes in the book how he's back in Dunedin, and he straight away gets a job at 4XO. So he's really back on his feet and feeling really great. And that 1980, the Clean really, they just practiced their hearts out, and they solidified themselves for what would happen in 1981. So He would have been grateful to have met someone like you who understood the value of the creative life, you know, because
which is you can either do it or you can't, you know, you can learn certain parts of it, like as they learnt to play, because neither of them knew how to play, those Kilgour brothers, when they started, did they?
No, well, but you've got to be brave enough to pursue that life. It's not an easy life, you know. I pursued a creative life sometimes, but also had a conventional life that paid money. You know, I understand that having many musician mates, it takes guts to do what they do. But the Kilgours had no option. Their great skill was to write music and play it in their own manner. And the same with Robert Scott. You know, they were just born to do it. They really were, but they had to work at it, and they worked really, really hard. That was the other thing I found about them. Found out about them was just how hard they worked, and that's why, you know, they loved Peter Gutteridge, their first bass player. He was a soulmate, but they still had to let him go because he didn't practice hard enough. So, you know, it was interesting to find out just how they applied themselves, and because you sort of thought they were sort of not beatnik characters, but you know, they were definitely alternative kind of characters. But it didn't stop them, you know, having real drive, real ambition, which is why they ended up having an existential meltdown in Christchurch in 1979 as teenagers when they tried to get to Auckland. They just tried to run before they could walk, really.
I'm talking with Richard Langston, the author of The Clean and The Dream Life You Need a Rubber Soul. And Richard's chosen three songs to play for us this morning. One, Anything Could Happen. Should we have a spin of it, Richard?
Oh, I think we should, Karen. Just this was the one for me that, well, remember the video on Radio with Pictures, just the coolest thing we'd ever seen on television. That was produced by local people. Just a genius song, genius look. Hallelujah, brother, we're here.
BFM and The Clean, Anything Could Happen. And I'm talking with author Richard Langston and about his new biography on The Clean called In the Dream Life You Need a Rubber Soul. That's a classic New Zealand song, without a doubt, isn't it, Richard?
Oh, just beautiful. And It sort of combines the brothers, the Kilgour brothers, chief music loves. You know, there's a bit of Rolling Stones in there, and that's David, and there's a bit of Bob, was a lot of Bob Dylan in there. That Hamish wrote that lyric, and Hamish wrote so many of their great lyrics. He was he was a literary student at Otago University. He was offered honours. You know, he was a language person. He was, very gifted. So, and he that song, it has so many Dylan-y references in it. Doorways, Out on the Highway, Ask a Dancer, and yeah, he honed in. He was such a fan of the Beats and Dylan and Ginsberg, all those people. In fact, he had a big, massive volume of Ginsberg's poetry. And so, you know, he was plugged in, wired into the counterculture. And he fed David that as well.
Yeah, and in the book, David Kilgour confesses that he ripped off the Enemy with Anything Could Happen, and their track Pull Down the Shades, and the chord structure, E, B, and A. He says there's something religious about the chords, E, A, and B major.
Yeah, I think he says, I learned that off Lou Reed.
Yes, he does, yeah.
Sorry, Karen, it was just great this week to see Alec Bathgate, who was such an influence on David when David was learning to play guitar. Alec played some covers this week of The Clean with three members of The Bats at the Christchurch launch of the book. And it was just great to see Alec sort of honoured David by playing the guitar lines. It was a real thing to see, you know, because those two have grown up side by side and, influenced each other. And they were, Alec was, and Chris Knox were really important early on, the Enemy. And I think the book shows just how the Enemy, Chris Knox and Alec Bathgate, really validated the Clean when everybody else thought they were a terrible, sort of racket. The Knox and Bathgate saw the magic in the core of it.
Yeah, Chris Knox loved them. He couldn't say enough about them. And he went overseas with them as well on tour.
Yeah, well, that was the moment too, because that was the third coming of the Clean, if you like, and that they reformed to do that tour with Chris in 1989. After they had reformed briefly the year before in London and played a couple of gigs, because of the lack of communication and international communication and feedback to New Zealand about how the Clean were being received overseas, they didn't kind of understand that they had an audience already in the USA and Europe, because their records were released in the States and in Europe in the mid-80s, a compilation. So people hooked onto them, like a Pavement, Yola Tango, all these American indie bands really were influenced by that record. And by the time the Clean went on their first international tour in 89 with Chris Knox, and thank God Chris went, because he took the most beautiful pictures, black and white, that are in the book on that tour, which Barbara Ward kindly handed to us for the book. And I'm just so grateful to all the photographers whose work's in the book. It's incredible.
Wonderful shots and artwork.
There's the Clean's artwork. So you can't, I said to the publisher, I said, if this book doesn't look great, we have failed the Clean, because it's not going to be difficult to make it look great. And I have to say, we, AUP, Auckland University Press, wow, the care they took with this book. And we had a great designer in Katie Kerr. And the thing is, Karen, the Kilgours have strong opinions. And so David was... It was always a back and forth. They were very involved in the production of the book, down to the cover title in The Dream Life You Need a Love Rubber Soul being in lowercase. So, you know, they really had input, and that was the only way to do it, as a kind of communal thing, because the Clean were very much a community band, in that they always inspired people, had, encouraged people. So it was done in that spirit as well.
And going back to the lineup from 1980 with Robert Scott, he was at the perfect fit for the Clean and the Kilgour brothers. They just gelled together really well. And as well as you know, their musical life and how they worked together as a band, I really love to read a bit about their respective families, their parents and their siblings, and the letters, for example, that Hamish wrote to his cousin, John Lewis.
Yes, John Lewis in Christchurch. Yeah. He was the same age.
How did you get all of that stuff?
Well, that was fascinating. So the book's essentially an oral history, and thank God I did it that way. Well, that was the only way we were going to do it. But David and I both love that form of musical history. So we started with interviews, obviously, and then I went to his house. I went in the winter of 2024. I went to Dunedin a lot. I took 3 months off my job as country calendar editor, director, and went to Dunedin and spent a lot of time with David. And he kept finding letters, diaries, Hamish's poetry journal, they kept all this stuff. David had kept letters he'd written to his girlfriend Genevieve in 1979 from the Glue Pot Tavern, describing they've just had their best crowd of 600 and things are going well. Although one of them, he says, "I'm 18 and I'm getting wrinkled."
Yeah, I read that and thought, yeah, right. I don't think so.
wait for what's to come, buddy. Anyway, right up until the last moment, they were finding bundles of letters. The letters to John Lewis were found really late in the piece. And so I could just slot them in, you know. It was like a documentary where you could just slide something in. But if it had been written if I had synthesized it, written it as a prose book, it would have been a disaster. I would have had to unstitch the whole thing all the time. And Bob Scott found that picture of them, of the Kilgour brothers standing on the roof in New York when the planes have hit the towers in 9/11.
Yeah, they were so
close. And Bob found, amazing shot. And Bob found that, like, I think about it, a couple of days before the deadline, you know. So bless them for finding it. Bob was also great, an archivist and having dates, as was Alec Bathgate, who kept every date of the Enemy gigs and Toy Love. And that was invaluable in trying to keep a track on the Clean, you know, because they weren't so date orientated and annotating everything. But they were, I mean, Hamish drew those song lists and their works of art in themselves that were in the Clean diary. Just amazing.
All right, Richard, let's play Someone, and this comes off Vehicle, the album Vehicle.
It does, and it's really short, really unadorned, and I just love the way that it starts, as if they've been playing for a minute and someone says, "Oh, we should probably record this, it sounds damn good."
Okay, here's Someone, the Clean.
Take some decisions, then act out with them. Only by doing this will you learn anything at all. Someone might love you, someone might care. You decide to take a step forward, not take two steps back. Yeah.
95 BFM and Someone from the Clean, and I'm talking to Richard Langston, author of a new biography on the Clean called In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul. We've got a few more minutes, Richard, so there's so much to find out in this book, and it just really fills in so many gaps if you're a Clean fan.
Yeah, well, I wrote it for the fans because me being a fan, I think I knew what I wanted to know, and that's why I was always digging for that sort of stuff that a fan would want to know. So there's a lot of talk about how they recorded songs, how they wrote songs, what they were inspired by, because that's all the stuff I wanted to know as a music person. You sort of want to know, how did this eventuate? How did this band find its voice? It's such a unique voice, the Clean, and that, you know, this their story is being published in the USA and in Europe at the same time by another publisher up there, and that's just fantastic, and a tribute to the Clean's, you know, how well they have traveled, how well their music and their reputation, they're just so highly thought of, you know, as a foundation band in indie rock, and they influence so many people.
Yes, and we know how the story ends, unfortunately. It's a tragic end.
Yeah, it is. Difficult.
A very difficult end. I think you handled that really well. How has it been on the book tour? You're 2 dates. Oh, well, you're the 3rd date. You're coming up to Auckland shortly?
Yes, on the Flying Nun store on Wednesday night. And so musicians playing really... The goodwill for musicians towards the Clean's incredible. So people have turned out everywhere. I mean, the Clean themselves played in Dunedin at the launch this week.
How brilliant. David and
Robert and a young drummer from Purley, Josh, and they were sensational. I mean, we levitated. It was just the magic. The magic was still there, you know. And it wasn't like they were trying to approximate how they were. They just be the Clean now. And it was just the same magic. It just was incredible sound and power and energy, the energy of that music. And David winging off on guitar, and Bob's propulsive bass, you know, yeah, and this lovely young drummer just slotting in there, you know, wow. And then in Christchurch, as I say, Alec Bathgate and members of the Bats played, so, and Roy Montgomery played. So it's just been a magic time. I'm so grateful.
Yeah, Roy's featured in the book throughout as well, says some wonderful things about the band. At the Flying Nun store here, what is there any... thing of that nature, yes. Proposed?
Yeah, there is exactly that. I mean, SJD, Jim Nothing, and Buzz Moller from Voom are playing, if you can believe that. What a lineup! And that's a tribute again to Dave. You know, I said to them all, oh, David Kilgour asked you if you would play, and so the immediate thing is, wow, thank you, yes, we'll do that. You know, and Vera Allen too was going to play, but she's overseas,
yeah, so, she's right,
you know. Yeah, no, and I love Vera Allen. So, you know, it's a whole generational thing too, that, you know, a band in Dunedin called SOG, S-O-G-G, have done a version of Point That Thing.
Yeah, I played it last week, actually. What a great version.
Oh, well done. Good on you.
So good. Richard, I came away from this book liking this band even more for their anti-commercial stance and very much for their realness. Because they really encapsulated so much about New Zealand at that time, and, you know, and they fought against that, and right up until Hamish's death, and still now, you know, they're fighting against the establishment, really.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, on that, their honesty and their rawness, you know, that's why those difficult chapters had to be truthful and had to be as close to the truth, because that was the Clean style. We would never, they did not want to gloss over what happened to Peter Gutteridge and Hamish at the end of their lives. They wanted to tell that story because they believed that will help people who struggle, that even people who are very, very successful and gifted have difficulties in life. And so I take my hat off to them for doing that, you know. And you're right, you know, the Clean from the outset would never ever have signed with a major label. It was just wrong. So when they leave Flying Nun in the 90s, they go to Merge, an indie record label in the USA. So that tells you about, they didn't just talk the talk, they lived their talk, you know, they lived their spirit and their truth. Wow.
Wow, indeed. Well, it's very poignant, very powerful biography. Congratulations, well done. You did a fantastic job. And let's leave with In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul, the title track. Thank you, Richard.
Beautiful, Karen, thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too.
BFM and In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul. We've been talking with Richard Langston about the biography on the Clean called that, In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.